the Gladys District, about 27 square miles, population right at 100,000 people. Police Department, we have about 150 sworn personnel and another 100 civilian, and about 65 volunteers that work in our VIP program. We are trying to do several things to stay on top of some of the issues that we're confronted with in the criminal justice system, witness identification being one of those. One of the things that our organization is doing is we are going through what's called the Texas Police Chiefs Association Recognition Program, which is pretty much like an accreditation program at the state level, in which 160 standards have been identified that a police department should be able to meet to become a recognized agency in the state of Texas. It was designed by the Texas Police Association to raise the level of the profession of policing in this state. Our department's going through it. One of the standards that has not been written yet is a standard on witness identification, and that is a standard that's in the process of being developed by the board and will be adopted by the board. I anticipate sometime even towards the end of this year, first part of next year. I would also anticipate that once that standard is developed, that the procedures that you'll see outlined here in this program will at least meet, if not exceed, the standards that will probably be adopted by the TBCA Recognition Board. I brought with me two people who have been with the department for quite some time. On your left is Lieutenant Danny Martin. He's actually serving in capacity right now as an acting captain in patrol, while our regularly assigned captain is at the FBI National Academy. Lieutenant Martin was previously assigned as a commander in our Criminal Investigations Division and helped write the eyewitness procedure. He attended the Actual Innocence Program up in Plano this year. Detective Adam Perry has been with the department for 13 years. Danny's been with us 22 years as of this past Monday. Detective Perry has worked in several different units within our department. He's currently assigned in our Criminal Investigation Division as detective and has become instrumental in the development of this from the line level, which I see as crucial, because both of these guys, particularly Detective Perry, has been able to get in there and work from the peer level and educate his peers and the people he works with why this procedure is so important. And the PowerPoint you're about to see in the presentation they're going to give you is pretty much what they're taking through our organization right now to train our organization in what we're doing and why we're doing it. He's added a little bit more historical information for the benefit of the unit, but this is primarily what you'll see going on in our department right now. They've already presented this to our command staff, and it is continuing throughout the department. So I'm going to turn it over to them and let them go through the presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to start out first with just a little introduction about why we've changed, what those changes are. And then after I get through with that, I would like to hand it over to Detective Perry so that he can address you in regards to what a detective, the guy in the trenches, what he actually sees on the changes that we've been doing. Why change? Well, as you heard the doctor say earlier, mistaken eyewitness identification is responsible for 75% of the false eyewitness identifications that have taken place in the nation. The 200 plus exonerations and 75% of those have been based on faulty eyewitness identification. And as the doctor said, there's a large body of scientific research that exists now that can help us in regards to this. And we've looked at this, we've embraced this, and we feel really comfortable with it on our level as officers and as detectives. The witnesses out there, they all have different perceptions. And perception can become reality. Just the other night in our department, we had a robbery that occurred where the witness comes forward and says, two armed men confronted me in the parking lot. I wasn't afraid. I tried to grab the gun. The gun misfired, and they took off running, and I chased them. And then he says they got in the car. They fired a shot back in my direction. They took off. Well, then we contacted a witness who's up in the upstairs apartment, and she said, well, I heard a gunshot, and I looked out, and I saw two guys chasing the victim across the parking lot. So his story of events as chasing these robbers versus them chasing him, which in reality was a little different. So there's a variety of reasons why people come forward. Some is the weapon focus we've heard about before, where they're focusing on that weapon. others may be molding the story a little bit. A lot of it just has to do with some of the scientific principles that the doctor addressed earlier. Again, the U.S. Department of Justice in their study back in 1999 came forward some studies in regards to this that you'll see that we'll address in our program. And we just, the bottom line is, we just think it's the ethical thing to do is to get accurate information so we can have successful prosecution of those parties who are guilty and to protect the innocent. And that's what it's all about, and that's what we're trying to do with the Richland Police Department. In our department itself, we have had a DNA exoneration. Back in 1985, in our city, there was a guy by the name of Robert McGowan. Mr. McGowan was convicted and given a life sentence for a sexual assault of a woman in 1985 in her Richardson apartment. That conviction was based in large part on eyewitness testimony. But at the same time, it's important to point out, even at that time, the detective in the case got the warrant, was trying to locate this person, couldn't locate the individual, filed the warrant at large. Once he had the person arrested, tried to interview him, couldn't get any information, had gotten some evidence at the scene. There was a rape kit exam done, went to the forensic lab. And at the time, based on the science at the time, there was not enough seminal fluid there for them to positively say who or who was not the actor. As time went on, there were scientific advancements. And 22 years later, in April of this year, science had advanced enough so that that DNA comparison could be done, and it resulted in the exoneration of Mr. McGowan. There were 19 DNA exonerations in Dallas County, all of except one from the murder case, which is based heavily on eyewitness identification. And we believe, and not only because of this, but just because we believe it's the right thing to do based on the evidence, that we need to move forward and make some positive changes. And what I'd like to do now is kind of get into some of the changes we've made over the years, even before the Robert McGowan situation happened, we were making changes.
And I have to turn one question based on the thing that Jerry was presenting earlier.
Yes, sir.
What percent, I mean, obviously the exonerations are occurring because of the biological evidence of some type of blood, but
yes,
the vast majority of our things that people are convicted to depends on the DCFJ.
Absolutely.
They do not have biological evidence associated with them, but they do have a lot of witness identification. What percentage of the cases do you see that are basically you have biological evidence versus those that you're dealing with now with the lineup situation that are not biological? Okay.
By far, most of the biological evidence that you're going to see, DNA evidence you're going to see, is going to be, as Dr. Wells pointed out, is going to be sexual assaults. There are occasions where there may be some additional DNA evidence. There's occasions, even as simply as a burglary, where someone may have less blood droppings because of a cut on the hand because of broken glass. But those cases are not, I don't have exact percentages for you, sir, but those cases are not very high. By far, it's going to be sexual assault. But I think that's even stresses the point even more so why we need to move forward with these policies, is that all these individuals that we see in the sexual assaults, we have 200 plus exonerations in those because of DNA evidence. How many other sexual assaults where there is no DNA evidence? And most importantly, the robbers. I mean, there are robberies happen every day, and those where there's no DNA evidence. What's happening with those? Lots of times, those robbery cases are based on eyewitness testimonies. Whether it's through a photo lineup, whether it's through that field identification, that show up is based on that eyewitness identification. So we can take that and probably, sure, if we had DNA evidence, come up with another 200 generations of robberies, and realistically, you know, even more beyond that, because we just don't know. And we never will, because the evidence is not there. I hope that answers your
question.
In 92, we had a prohibition put in place not to show a single photo as an eyewitness identification procedure. We also stated that you must use all color or all black and white photos back in 92. In the McGowan case at the time, it was a combination of black and white photos, photocopies of the photos, and color photos. And you have to remember at the time, there was a transition in technology. We had traditionally had black and white photos. And we had started to move into color photos. And there was not a large selection. We didn't have computerized databases to access and put in like we do today, you know, give me some height, give me some weight. We didn't have that. And I can remember myself personally as a detective in the early 90s where we literally had shoeboxes. And we went to these shoeboxes and pulled photos. Not because we were negligent, not because we were lackadaisical, but that is what we had at the time, and that's what we did. And, you know, I can remember saying, okay, this guy, this is photo lineup, if somebody positively picks him out, he's going to have to impound on six photos, and six less photos for me to use in mine. And, you know, it's just, it sounds almost comical, but it's in the same sense. It's tragic when you think about the big picture and how this can affect other people. Back in 92, we also instituted the minimum six-person lineup. We've also, as time has passed on since 92, witnesses are being lined up separately. Instructions are given to the witness. And this is all prior to the changes that we've made here recently. These are all things we've had in place since the 90s. Those instructions about, you know, a person may or may not be in the lineup, the hair and the facial hair may change, those type of things, that you're not obligated to make a selection. All those things are in place in the 90s as we move forward. And now we have our photos are obtained from the jail module of RMS, which is our records management system, where you can input height, weight, sex, age, et cetera, to get a better filter. In 2006, Chief Zacharias attended the Actual Innocence Conference for the first time, and I believe that was the first conference of the three thus far. He's had conversations, I know, with Marion Wiley in regards to best practices in regards to eyewitness identification. He's worked with Senator Ronnie Ellis last year. In April of this year, I attended the Actual Innocence Conference, and that was held during the same week that the exoneration came forth on Mr. McGowan. And it was very eye-opening for me personally because I went to the school. This thing was happening in my department. And the detective who was there at the time and with Mr. McGowan is still with our department. And I've had conversations with him. And that, and listening to the actual individuals at the conference themselves who have spoken about their personal experiences and exonerations, it really hit home to me why we need to do this, because we all want the same thing. We want to put that guilty guy in jail, and we want to exonerate the innocent.
Excuse me, the Actual Innocence Conference you're referencing, is that the one in Kale that's on the plan?
Yes, I was there in April.
Corey Brown fails to pay for that.
I remember you. I even made reference to that at the time, too. And then when I came back from the conference in April, that was about the same time as McGowan exoneration, and we started having informal conversations at the department about what we should do moving forward. We started slowly with it, talking to detectives, trying to get buy-in. Adam is in our crime against persons unit, which handles murder, which handles sexual assault, which handles robberies. And he was one of the first detectives to embrace the concept and say, let's listen to it, it sounds good. Eventually, we got more detectives on board with this. And this was before we actually instituted our order. Our order does not officially go into effect until tomorrow, on October 31st. It officially goes into effect. But we didn't want to wait for the bureaucratic process of getting that done. We knew we had a problem. We knew we wanted to act on it and prevent things from happening, perhaps in the interim. So we started that in the Crimes Against Persons Unit, which by and far is handling most of these types of situations that you see with the eyewitness identifications. Because of the cases that they receive, sexual assaults, again, the murders, again, the robberies. What have we actually done in the Richmond Police Department? What are our new procedures? We have, I call it the independent administration of lineups. It's the double blind lineup. We have instituted the double blind lineup. And again, that is where the detective and the person in the lineup does not know who the suspect or person we believe to be the suspect is in that lineup. We had started that around July, and we've continued to do that, and we'll continue to do that with our new order effective tomorrow. We've also, the issuance of civic instructions, as I said earlier, we've had those in place since the 90s, but we've moved forward now to enhance those instructions. We've added the, and I've got folders for each of you in there, one that has a copy of our PowerPoint, has a copy of our new general order, it has a copy of our former order, and also it has two forms that go with the new order, one is which is specific to photo lineups, and the other, which is specific to field identification show-ups, so that the officers have that. We'll go into that in a little bit here, too. Also, we have the statement of certainty has been added. We have in there the police officer is required to ask you to state in your own words how certain you are of any identification. And the way that we do that is if they pick a photo out, again, we don't give them any feedback. We have them write the statement of certainty out. So they have their own words. We don't step in there and they say, okay, well, I think it's photo number three. You know, hey, you picked the right guy. Great. Well, now they're reinforced that this is the right guy and they're writing out this great statement. Well, we let them put their statement right on its own, on their own merits, on what they think, how certain they are representing identification. And again, we tell them in our statement, in our order to give them, that the officer administering the lineup does not know the identity of the perpetrator. So it may be great that we go in there and we don't know the identity of the perpetrator, but if we don't tell them, they may still be looking to you for some cues, and you may just rub your nose at the wrong time, and they may take that as, hey, it's going to be the guy. We want to eliminate any possibility of anyone saying that that detective knew, detective gave some type of cue to that person. Position. We're going to place the suspects in different positions in each lineup. That's both across cases and also with multiple witnesses in the same case. In other words, the detective is not going to do the photo lineup, six-person photo lineup, always choose number three as being suspect. Generally, word is going to get out sooner or later that, hey, if you go to the police department, number three is the guy. We don't want to do that. And also, if you have multiple witnesses, we don't want those witnesses talking to each other, but if something does happen and that conversation takes place, we want to make sure that first witness, if it's in position number three, then the next witness that sees it is position number five, or so on and so forth. So again, there's no possibility of that information being transferred to them inadvertently. Again, as I said earlier, we don't want to get any feedback to them when they make that selection. We don't want to
when you have multiple witnesses, do you present the same lineup to them? Not necessarily the same order, the same people or whatever.
You have the same people, but you're changing up the order of that lineup.
But you at least try to make sure the same people there. You can have them on different days, but if not.
Yes, we're using that same lineup.
And we'll do that.
So what we'll do is we'll change the fillers. If I show two different people, two different photo lineups.
Because you might not have the same filler available a week later that you had.
Well, with the databases that we use, we have hundreds to thousands of photos that we can pick from.
Okay, so it's just a photo lineup is what you're talking about.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Photo lineup. We'll get into the show-ups, fill indications towards the end here. Right now, what we're talking about strictly is the photo lineup. And the procedure should be documented. We require that the lineup be video recorded. And what we've done is we've got a new, in our agency, we're blessed with the ability to just have a new digital video system put in. And we believe it's beneficial. We've been videotaping our witness interviews for years at the Richmond Police Department. Our guys think nothing of going in there and doing interviews with witnesses and suspects and having people take. And this is us just carrying that on to these folks and these lineups and showing that lineup there. And again, we've got the double blind in place, but again, we know that when it goes to court, someone's going to try to plant that reasonable doubt there. And yes, it was a blind lineup, but yes, you can see nothing was said. There's no cues being given. And try to make it as transparent as possible of what we did, and because we're not ashamed of what we're doing now.
If I could interject something real quick about the videotaping, Because Dr. Wells talked about the poor quality of video and audio that's on video, and no one other than these guys can tell you how absolutely true that has been. But when we built our new building several years ago, we've got five integrated interview rooms that are kind of semi-soundproof. They're private. You can't see a camera. You can't see a microphone, but yet they're in there. We just, as Danny said, just recently converted to high-quality digital. So the problem is no, that problem no longer exists with us because of the equipment that we've been able to purchase. And we're also talking about when we do this at the station. You know, you can't drag along all the video equipment all the time with you, but we did have the auditory recording mandated as well. But more times than not, they will try to get the witness to come in and view it at the station as opposed to doing the field. That way we can get the video.
Chief, is this pursuant to a written policy, or is it just something that you did?
It's pursuant to the new written policy. It was something that was being done, as Lieutenant Martin talked about, and our interviews have been recorded for probably 15 years on audio video.
And is the recording of interviews pursuant to a written policy?
Yes, it is.
Do they know that they're being recorded?
You got it? They do not. The camera is hidden in there, and they do not see that, and they do not know they're being recorded.
Is that because of prior, you told them, and they demonstrated reluctance, or that was just from the beginning?
You saw? Well, just for example, you take someone into an interview room, you start talking with them, and they confess, they tell you a lot of information. They say, hey, well, I need you to write that down. Well, I can write that down, but I'll be more happy to talk to you. We've got them it just protects the person who's in there, protects the detective that's in there.
You have a warning that they're given on tape.
Right. All again, it's all about the transparency of what we're doing. And we, as far as the recording of these photo lineups, that is in our new policy in effect. It goes into effect tomorrow. But we have, in fact, been doing it since this summer. After we started talking about, let's do these changes, let's not wait for the bureaucratic process to get this work done. Let's start doing it so we can move anything.
But you don't tell the witnesses that they're being
paid. Yeah, sure. We do. And again, as Chief alluded to, actually each detective has issued their own visual audio report. So if they do have to go out on the scene, whether it's talking to a witness without a photo line or with a photo line, they have the ability to audio record that. We've also implemented the sequential lineup procedure where the witness can use only one photo at a time. Again, as Dr. Wells alluded to, that helps somewhat in preventing relative judgments. And when I get at the end of this, Detective Perry's going to talk about his experiences in regards to the double line, in regards to the sequential. He's going to tell you from his perspective as a guy in the trenches how he's seen the reaction of witnesses and things of that nature. But we believe combined with independent administrator presenting the lineups, photos sequentially rather than simultaneously, that it will help reduce the rate of misidentifications. Now, we have been doing this, as I said, since July. So I can't sit here and tell you what's going to happen once we get to trial, what's going to happen at that point. But I can tell you, and I can tell you what's happened on the front end during the initial stages of the investigations. And hopefully, in the near future, we can give you some information regarding what
you're doing. You're collecting that data.
I'm sorry,
excuse me. Unintentionally collecting the data that will show us someday or not too distant future results.
Yes, we're going to do that because we want to see what those results are. And so we can see that and track those. We've done probably around 30 thus far.
When you use the sequential method, are witnesses allowed to go back through?
I'll answer that. The process that we use is, to answer that question, yes. What we do is we show them one photo, we let them look at it as long as they want, we save the rest of the photos. When they're ready, they tell us to move on to the next photo, then we show them the next one. And then when they're ready, we show them the next one. They never know how many photos they're going to see. They never know when it's going to end because we put it back in the scale. If they want to go back through it, they're able to do that. But really what it's doing, and this is my opinion and my experience, is it's forcing them to rely on their memory. And one of the problems that that I found or that I noticed in doing the six-person photo lineup is it allows that individual looking at the photos to select characteristics from the six photos and say, and just like Dr. Wells said, well, he had this jawline or this hairline and this one looks closest to it, and they can look at all six of those collectively or together and choose from that. And then they circle it and then they say, this is the one we want. I believe that with the sequential lineup, it allows them to just rely on their memory. They have to know the image in their head and look at that photo and say, that's not it, as opposed to all six of them in front of them. So that's a procedure that we've adopted. It seems to be working. It seems to me to be a lot better policy than the six-person photo. And that, like I said, it prevents them from selecting of the six which one's the better candidate. I'll tell you, and I know this is a little bit blind, I was reluctant at first to buy off on this. Most of us were. It was a policy that we've had. In the 13 years I've been here, we've done a six-person photo lineup. I didn't see any issues with it. I hadn't had any issues with it. When the chiefs came back and the administration came back and they started pointing out some of the problems that Dr. Wells has talked about and Captain Martin's talked about, it was apparent that there really were problems, and I started looking back thinking, oh, you know, I'm just as guilty as doing that. And I'll give you a case in point in a minute, but one of the things that we did, one of the big things in the independent administration is we really were giving verbal clues, and we didn't know we were doing it. Right before the statement of certainty, they would select that person that was their best guess, and we'd go, yeah, that's right. That's the same person I thought it was. And then for them, it was a big relief. And to be totally honest, it was a big relief to us, too, because some of them we weren't that sure about. So it worked out for both of us. They would pick it, and we would pick it, and we'd both high-five each other, and yeah, that's got to be it, because you agree and I agree. So what we found is if we use that blind administrator, it forces that individual to use their own judgment. Forces that individual, if you do it sequentially, to go off their memory and to go off of their perspective and not ours. We started doing the independent administration. We started doing the sequential method. I believe that we can't influence the decision of the witness if it's done that way, if it's done properly. I believe that there are a lot of opportunities, like Dr. Wells said, and like Captain Martin said, for us to influence somebody. And I've seen it. And I've inadvertently done it, and I didn't realize it until this research started coming out, that if done sequentially and blindly, that the witness has a better chance of going off of their own memory. Case in point, I had a robbery case, an aggravated robbery. It was a gentleman who was assaulted and he was robbed. He was beaten up pretty bad, shattered his leg. This was done in a park. There was three males and a female. Through photo record or phone records, I was able to identify one of the suspects who was one of the males. But the key player in this was that female. Well, he gave us a pretty decent description of the female. One of his associates from previous criminal behavior was identified, and she matched the description of the guy. She matched the description of the woman that he was describing. I put her in a six-person photo lineup, the old process. I handed him my witness or my victim, the photo lineup, and I said, okay, I believe we have identified one of the people that, or the female that attacked you. Can you figure out? And he looked at it and he went through them and he started doing just what I said. He started comparing the photos and he did circle it. And by golly, that's exactly what I thought it was. And I went and got a warrant for her, brought her into the jail, and during the investigation, my gut started telling me, well, maybe she's, I mean, she was adamantly denying. She wasn't anywhere near there. She didn't know anything about it. But this guy was 100% sure, because of what I told him and because of what he knew before that, that that was the person. And just like Dr. Will said, I didn't realize that I'd done that. What happened was during the interview with the witness, he mentioned that she had a tattoo on the small of her back. Had her stand up. I remember that about three quarters of the way into the interrogation. Had her stand up, turn around, and there's no tattoo back there. She was positively identified as the person who was a player in that. And I believe that had that tattoo not shown up, she would have been charged with that offense that she did commit. So That's an example. It happens. It's not intentional on our part, but as a detective, you know, we have pressure to solve this case, both from the public, from the administration, our own. But going back to this new system, I'm a firm believer in it. That one stood out of my mind instantly when we started looking at some of the research and literature that's coming out on this. It's still new to our department. We still have some reluctancy. We just now have a written policy that's now mandating it. I'm a firm believer in it now based on what I know as a detective. But I can tell. I truly believe that it is a better policy than the way we've done the six-person photo lineup if done properly. Any questions?
Okay. I think it's very compelling, as I said earlier, to have the guy in trenches tell you this, because as you can see, Adam genuinely believes us, and his enthusiasm is spread to the rest of the unit and calls and embraces it. And when you get your guys on the street that can truly believe in this, then you're making some progress. You're not just, you know, verbalizing something. You're not just going through the motions. The guy on the street, the guy who's the practitioner himself, believes it, and he's going to carry it out the way that we intended.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What prompted you all to do this?
This has been, again, the evidence has been going on. I mean, obviously, as Dr. Wells pointed out, I mean, you can read the Dallas Morning News any day and see the exonerations that have taken place. We had our own exoneration that took place in April. But the chief, you know, went to the Akron Innocence Conference in 2006, first got that initial information. Sorry, had some conversations with Senator Ellis.
But I guess what I'm really getting at is why aren't more police departments doing this?
Well, I think there's some reluctance. I mean, even when I went myself, I looked at the conference and I decided myself that I was going to go to it. I looked at it and I said, okay, well, Barry Sheck's going to be a presenter, you know. That'll be interesting just to hear the guy from the O.J. Simpson trial, you know. So you get up there, you go. Barry was very outspoken, very rational about his arguments. And I became a firm believer, again, listen to those guys who were the exonerees that were there. And again, with that taking place the same week as our exoneration of Robert McGowan, it really drove it home. Having the ability to talk to that detective. And again, the chief had seen some of this coming up, but he wanted to get some more hard evidence to see this thing moving forward that was the right thing for us to do. And I think as time went on, we saw that it was the right thing to do. I mean, you get the initial information, you just don't jump off into it on a wild hair. You get some information, you see what's happening. What's happening in North Carolina? What's happening in New Jersey? You know, what's happening here in our own backyard in Dallas? What's happening with us with Robert McGowan? It was a series of events that took place over a period of time, which ultimately led us to
this. Do you think that it's going to have to be by law to require most police departments to do this?
I don't think so. I can tell you that this program for us, for our particular police department, works for us, and we believe in it, and we've got things in place that will make it work. I think Dr. Wells hit on a good point when he made the point about there's plus and minuses to both, but if you get the best policies out there and tell them this is the way to go, they're going to start doing it. They're going to start doing that research. They're going to start hitting those links. They're going to start looking for those other policies, and they're going to build them up. And I know the chief does great work with the chief association, and he'll be a great ambassador for this as well. But as we move forward, and you got guys like this who go and they talk to other detectives in our neighboring cities about how it works, it's a slow process, but it's going to work. But I don't personally like the mandated idea, but I think we can move forward.
Let me continue answering your question. We were fortunate, I think, in that we were able to be exposed to the programs that were going on. And, you know, back in the 90s when I started working with the state legislature through the Chiefs Association, it wasn't really then until I realized how rural this state still is and how rural it's going to remain. And that's where we're going to have some issues, and it will take longer for some of the rural agencies to become exposed to this, to understand what's going on, to understand what the issues are, and there's several ways we can get past that. You know, here we are almost 2009, and I left the program in 2006. And so it was not flipping a switch that made our department change. It was, we were exposed to it, we questioned it, we studied it, we looked at it, We recognized what the issue was. Dudley's back there that I worked with on Senator Ellis's bill. He'll tell you that two other police groups went to him and said, we can't support this. We're not going to work for this. And I went to Dudley and said, I've been to this program, and I understand what you're trying to do, but let's go about it a little bit different way. And we started getting that bill moving. And it's going to take more and more chiefs to make that leap and look at it from a little bit different way before they start making that change. Now, one of the things that James McLaughlin and I do is we participate with the Law Enforcement Management Institute of Texas at Sam Houston with the required biannual training the chiefs have to go through. And we help write that curriculum. This will probably be end up being one of those curriculum items that chiefs have to go through to expand that exposure to get this process going, as well as what we're doing with the recognition program. Okay.
And Chief, I'll note that we're also, Chief and I are going to work with TCOS too, that they have promised to join in on this educational pursuit. So,
you may have answered part of the question that I had, and that is, what is the reception right now that you're getting from law enforcement communities statewide? Chief, you may have answered this too, about just standing up and saying to them what you just said to us. Is that are you being asked to do that? And when you say it, is it received positively, or are they saying no, that, you know, that's just something we don't want to want to hear?
I can answer from my perspective, but I don't know if they've been approached to talk to anybody.
I have not.
It's a mixed response right now. Some agencies are real familiar with the problem. I know in my conversations with some of the chiefs at Dallas, they are doing a study right now, participating in a study to see how they need to move forward with their witness identifications. There's some resistance. There's some that recognize it and, you know, will choose the time to go forward. And police departments they don't change overnight. And, you know, they're made up of people that are hired and trained to question and ask why, and they're skeptical, and so we go through it a different way.
What was the sense of opposition from other groups during the last day?
You know, I think say that again.
What was the opposition from the other law enforcement groups concerning was it part of the engagement?
There were a couple things. Part of the concern was that we would be having a law that would mandate specific procedures, right, which is one of the concerns. The other one is
with Jeremy saying something to the effect of, chief, you will, or city, you will develop your own policy.
Right.
And write a specific thing.
Right. Right. That was probably the biggest. Senator Ellis was trying to put together a group to do the study, and there was one of the recommendations I made to his office was, you're wanting to help develop policy. The people you have on there are policymakers. Let's get policymakers. You know, I think there is a psychological reason that some departments resist this because of the way they have seen some of the exonerations come out. That it's a resistance to being kicked into the teeth. And once you get past that, then you're okay. But when you feel like you've been kicked in the teeth, I think some have a natural resistance perspective with that. But it's just a matter of getting past that. I mean, it's just like Adam said. I mean, I've been doing it this way. I didn't have any problems. I've been able, you know. And then all of a sudden you go, oh, wait, maybe there are some problems. And so it's getting past the perception and the psychological and into the reality.
Do you have problems with prosecutors making changes?
We haven't yet, have we?
We haven't had any as you go to trial either, so it's still in the early stages. Still in our department.
I had one chief from a very large jurisdiction tell me that this was all garbage because of that report that came out of Chicago. We sent him information from Dr. Wells. So he could read that, but that's what he's on the line.
I think the basic tenet of this is good, sound, scientific principle. As we pointed out, but the analogy with the pharmaceutical studies, I think, is wrong.
You know, there's policing, as you all know, is not a perfect science. And there's a lot about it that has changed in the 31 years I've been doing it, and there's a lot of it that hasn't changed. But, you know, even the document that we gave you with that general order, we consider that a living document. When we find things in there that won't work, or that we believe are bad, or maybe a court rules some other way, we will change that document. But it's a process, and it's like, you know, I told Roger Jones from the Dallas Morning News, when you have these things, and particularly when they get that close, every police administrator has that ethical obligation to look to see if they're doing things the best way they can be doing.
There is your sense that any of the other local chiefs in the Dallas area are going to belong to what you're doing and also
get absolutely, absolutely. After that editorial came out, I had several emails from surrounding chiefs that were supportive of
the idea
and supportive of the position that the Morning News took.
Chief, is there something that you think either this commission or the legislature should do concerning this issue?
Well, we will work again with Senator Ellis's office to help with any study and help with the development of a standard. From an administrative and policing and legislative perspective, I'm not in favor of this commission recommending that there be legislation to come out and say you have to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I just, you know, Dr. Wells addressed that the same, that you have to have something in place to cover these issues to make sure X, Y, Z does not happen or the chance of that happening is lessened, as opposed to very specific legislative rules.
Could we write it in such a way that we have, you know, very general instructions, but with a few things that we say is minimum user?
You know, I'm going to jump out there and say you could probably take our recognition standard that we use and that be the standard for you. We're going to try to beat you to it.
Now we're
going to
try to beat you.
I've worked the legislature too long.
You get a question,
Richard. You know, you were talking about how rural the state is and how many departments there are. And given the sort of difficulty of persuading each department to their satisfaction of the benefits of these things, if there were some kind of a mandate of flexibility in it, how much time, based on your own learning curves, do you think departments would need to get up to speed and implement? What sort of lead time would be appropriate for some sort of flexible requirements that might be created?
Well, I don't know, James may be the better one to answer that, but we typically, when we've done that type of legislation, it's been at least a year.
But substantial times.
Right.
I mean, that's,
you know, because what will happen is particularly if there's curriculum that's developed, you have to have time to develop that. Then you have to have time, you know, you've got 2,200 law enforcement agencies that you have to cover. So, you know, look how long it took us to implement fully the you know, Senate Bill 1074, racial profiling.
How long?
That was an 18-month process.
So maybe.
And the crisis intervention training process was a 24-month process.
That's why we're talking about starting to train now.
Right.
I'd like to also talk a little bit about we call field identification, was also referred to as show-ups earlier. We have in our new order specific instructions in regards to that. And what we have, and you'll see this in your folder, is we have a field identification form. We've always had, not always, but we've had for since the 90s, the photographic line of instructions that the detective would give to the witness, to the victim. Out there on the field, when that patrol officer responds to the robbery and they catch a guy who's a block or two down the street, who generally gives a description, they bring him back. He has no actual written guidelines that he can go by. No, if you will, a cheat sheet to keep him within the curve lines there. So So we've instituted that now, so that now he has specific instructions that he will give to that witness out there to help resolve some of these issues. We've also mandated the videotaping of those show-ups, because we have video cameras in our cars. The cars have the in-dash video cameras. The officers have the lapel mics. Why not use that, again, to show that we're not being prejudicial, that we're not trying to move this witness in one direction. I can tell you that there's been a variety of ways to do those show-ups out there in Cross Texas. I'm sure it's even wider. I know a case in our own department earlier this year where some guys were caught and they were brought over there as witnesses, being brought over there to them. They're searching guys, they're pulling out a bandana out of the back pocket. I mean, those type of things are very prejudicial to that witness who's coming up there. We want to, and we've mandated, that the witness be transported to the suspect. What we don't want is for the suspect to show up in the back of the squad car handcuffed and zap the guy. You know, again, very prejudicial. We want the witness to go to the suspect. We're also going to say that if it can be safely done, that you don't handcuff that individual. Again, very prejudicial. There's an individual who's handcuffed. And we want to obtain from that witness, prior to them seeing the suspect, a full and detailed description so that we have that. We just don't say, well, is this, I saw this Hispanic male, he ran that way. Well, we want to sit down, okay, give me some height, give me some weight, give me some clothing, get some any details that you can think of about this individual before he sees this person, so we can have that in place, again, to help us in that regard. We think these are very important in regards to our identifications. I do think that the show-up is a valuable tool to law enforcement if it's handled the right way. If it's not handled the right way, it can have bad consequences. But I do think if we have these things in place, if we use the video car cameras, if we have the actual, again, like I said, the form that they can go by, that this is going to be a big help to us. We had a robbery yesterday, in fact, where the suspect was seen leaving. I called the lieutenant who was out there at the scene, and he told me what happened. He said, we're not going to do a bill identification. We're not going to show up because we've got enough evidence here to go ahead and bring this guy in, because he's got the credit cards that belong to the person. They knew that they can do a photo lineup afterwards. So we're also saying, if you've got that evidence, say, for example, we have multiple witnesses. This is another part of our program. You have multiple witnesses. Get one of those witnesses to go to show up, and they say, okay, this is or it's not the guy. If they identify the person, then the other witnesses never see him. They don't go to the show up. Those witnesses then come to the station later, and they have a photo lineup. So again, it's not based solely on that show up if you have multiple witnesses. So again, a variety of things put in place to try to, again, I don't think we'll ever fully eliminate human error. It's going to be there to some degree, but we can certainly minimize it. And we believe these steps do that. Again, the Bristol Police Department believes these procedures are viable, effective means to enhance witness identification, protect the innocent, and build stronger cases against actual perpetrators. Answer your questions.
All right, this is a general, just a follow-up basic to the question I asked earlier. Any of the local police, of course, our committee, get up and would you, say, come in January or February when we have legislation, but we're moving to do back to the same thing?
I think we will. I think if the Texas Police Chiefs Association recognizes that for the recognition program we need to develop a standard, then you're going to see the members of that organization stand up. This is what, and you know David James, who's the chief of Carrollton, he's being sworn in tomorrow as our president, and he's right there in the DFW area, so it's coming around.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I just want to put, coming from San Antonio, and I'm not advocating this, by the way, but San Antonio police were resistant for many, many years to videotaping defendant statements, confessions, even though they had technology and they didn't want to do it for obvious reasons, because they liked the opportunity to handwrite them or title them up to be a witness. Of course, after all the research came out and after they were cross-examined on the problems with that, numerous times, and they started losing cases, Now, I'm not advocating this commission did nothing, but down the road, I mean, I want to commend your office and your department for being ahead of the curve. But down the road, don't you see after, don't you think after these officers in other jurisdictions have been beat over the head with your best practices that it's going to change automatically?
I can just look at it from a different perspective. I know when I was there in April at the conference, is that there's a huge number of defense attorneys out there, and as I told our guys, I said, they know what these practices are. They know what the science is behind it. They know what the place is going. If you're on the stand and you're confronted about, well, did you ever think about a double blind? You know about this? I mean, you can really start putting that doubt in the jury's mind about what you've done and bring up these DNA exonerations. It is in the best interest of the departments themselves and people they serve that they have these in place to counter that so that we can all be comfortable knowing that we've got a true perpetrator and that we have not gone against an innocent person.
I'm going to ask you publicly, would you all be interested in one of our grantees, Kayla, was on the Innocence Conference, was very interested in the fact they have a division now for law enforcement training. Would you be interested in working with the court at KLA in presenting a conference for law enforcement through our Innocence Grant for other police officers?
Well, I think there'd be interest, of course. We want to, you know, get in and see what all that involves. But we're interested in taking this beyond our department because, you know, one of the things I commented to Danny and Adam, that they both had recognized that they're impacting our profession well beyond their city boundaries. And they recognize the significance of that and want to participate in that. It was the reason they were so willing to come down here. So I think we could talk about that and go further. One of the things in the future, actual innocence flyers that you send out, when I got mine, to me, read like it was primarily directed to defense and judges. And that's probably why the first one, you only had five of us there from law enforcement.
No, actually, we had a problem because the legislature had not allowed us to pay for law enforcement to attend. The legislature has seen the light and they've changed that. So now we can pay for law enforcement to attend. So those few officers that did come, KLAW paid for us.
Okay.
Now the grant can cover that. So.
Okay. Well, that's one of your that's one of your issues right there.
Any other questions that we can answer right
now?
Yeah, quick question. Back in, I think, 99 or so, the U.S. Department of Justice issued some best practices. I just wonder to what extent you all were familiar with those. I know that the federal government, to my knowledge, wasn't doing much of anything to promote those. Did you have awareness that there were some best practices out there prior to this recent?
I hadn't heard, Marshall, but information to be quite personal myself. I knew there was some stuff out there, but I didn't know the extent of it. And again, revelation to me personally was attending the conference. Now, the chief of this spoken prior to this.
Well, here's the other issue with that. DOJ has their list of best practices. PERF has their list of best practices. IACP has their best practices. Michigan State University has theirs. You know, you cannot read them all. There's thousands of them out there. And so to say, were you aware of this specific one? I wasn't. Because I usually don't correct my studies necessarily. But there's a lot of best practices out there. That's one of the reasons that we did. We took, you know, how many standards are there with CALEA?
400 and some odd.
Standards that you have to meet are the national accreditation. Texas, we specifically identified 160 specific to municipal police agencies here. And so it's difficult to go that way.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thanks very much, gentlemen. A few last notes. Our next meeting will be December 11th here at the Park Room, and Rose, you still have that box open? Okay. Well, thank you very much for attending, and please, if you have ideas or questions or helpful hints or whatever, please feel free to contact us. Thank you very much.
gave her his own virtual rules.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
That's why I suggested it's a training to change the word kill.
Check it out. 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 Check it They're very reasonable. So, I have suggested this idea, suggested it, and Whitmire, what dollars, she's a young, say, well, you know, give me, show me what's going on, so we, I don't do this, but I can talk about it, so, she met each other at the resolution, and then, someone goes back.